This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by www.starktruthradio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can read his articles and find out more on robertstark.substack.com.
Robert Stark here. I'm joined here with Meta Ronan. Meta Ronan, great having you back on.
Excellent. I'm glad to be back, Robert. Always fun.
So do we really have a coherent subject matter for this show, or it's just kind of like all over the place?
Yeah, the second. A lot
the theme,
here,
I would say.
Yeah. There's a lot of things we touch on, social status, politics, the oral sex question.
Right. I guess a good place to start on a more serious tone is, do you have thoughts on the current AI bubble, the future of tech, the tech recession, and impact on monetary policy?
Yeah, so I have a really intuitive approach to these things. I just see the big picture. And if anybody has some points they want to argue, I'm willing to drill down then and debate those specific points. Like any technology, you're going to have diminishing returns, and then another technology is going to have to take over and kind of make up for that difference, for that in order to keep, you know, the exponential curve of Moore's law and technology going, because I feel like that's the way the universe works, right? A huge exponential curve. There are billions and billions of years before the first single-cell life forms, then billions of years before multicellular life, but then each interval gets shorter and shorter, right? Like, we're living in a very interesting knee of the curve right now. You probably grew up with TV sets that you had to click the channel and adjust the antenna, and now here we are, right, on the internet, phones in our pockets that have access to the whole world. So as far as the AI bubble...
What is a bubble caused by monetary policy? But I guess the other argument is that if AI is so accelerating technologically that it could, like, will the bubble crash and cause like a massive tech recession or recession overall, or is like the innovation in AI like so happening at such a rapid, and obviously it's going to replace a lot of jobs, but will it be so accelerated at such a rapid pace to overcome the bubble? Because that's, well, the people were saying the same thing before the 2000.com bubble.
True. I think honestly that AI is going to take over a lot of jobs, but I think it's just not going to be as universally applicable as you think. You aren't going to have, you know, a bunch of iRobot looking androids just taking over, you know, hosting table, busing tables, you know, hosting at restaurants, working at the grocery store. There, you still need people for things. People are more comfortable when there's
already
another person.
But
yeah,
even with self-checkout,
what?
They
people
always have a person manning it.
yeah, exactly. So even when there are instances where, say, AI just guts out a lot of the workforce in that industry, like call centers, nobody wants to do that anyway. But say they did, and they did, then you'd still need people, you know, making sure that's running smoothly. So, you know, as far as the bubble goes, I think the fears are overblown. I think it's not going to happen. I can't see it happening fast enough that it's a shock to the system, is what I guess would be my view on that. And now, as far as, you know, monetary policy, it's going to be interesting after this election. I know you were saying you think Kamala is going to win, and I'm disagreeing on that politely.
I think Kamala will win unless we have a major economic crash before the election.
Now, why do you think that?
Well, based on the polling, and obviously polling is not always accurate. So, and based on like betting odds, she's ahead on betting odds, and betting odds actually are more accurate than polling. I mean, polling was wrong. Trump was losing in a lot of polling in 2016, and he still won. But like, betting odds are actually fairly accurate, and betting odds show her ahead. So, I'm not saying
Okay,
like,
I'll give you that.
Karen teaches him one. I think it's going to be extremely close. Like, she has, like, a slight advantage. But it is, I mean, there are, what is polarized, but there are also, there are undecided voters as well. But it is going to be really close. Probably one of the closest elections in history.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I was discussing this with somebody last night after the debates, basically that it just needs to be close enough for them to fake the rest of the votes, like what happened last time. I'm sorry. I do believe, I mean, there's fraud in every election from both sides, but I think Democrats did not want to see another Hillary. So they were ready this time, and bam, like you all saw the meme with the curve, right, that goes up and then suddenly spikes to beat Trump. But they have to come that close in order for that to pull through, and people are already going to be on guard against that. So it's going to be a little crazy, but if it ends up that Trump is just beating her by so much, they're not going to be able to fake the rest of the way. So
there could have been some level of voter fraud, but I don't think that was the big issue in 2020. I think the issue was demographic change, and also that Trump lost a lot of the original, he lost a substantial amount of the original, like, white working class Obama to Trump voters.
Yeah,
well,
I don't buy strongly
into that, like, voter fraud narrative as to why he lost.
I think it's all factors, but I do think that the mail-in ballots gave an enormous opportunity. If I were a Democrat and I really felt like Trump was a living reincarnation of Hitler, I would have done that. Oh, we're doing the right thing. We're saving the country. We're saving democracy by faking democracy. Yeah. So you think, barring, you know, an economic collapse, that Kamala will get it? As far as that goes, we keep printing more money, right? And that's just the money bubble is inevitable. I don't think we're ever going to stop. We've been, you know, ever since you can leverage a lot of debt and put it out there, you get people working and building things they wouldn't otherwise built if there was a one-to-one, you know, every gold brick had so many dollars, right? So I see that works, but yeah, bubbles are in danger of bursting. But I don't think it's going to be, you know, the next economic bubble bursts and then we're back to the Stone Age. I think the collapse is kind of a multi-stage collapse, right? We're going to just reach the next energy level of stability.
There are these
where
like
that is, I don't know.
Narratives about tech. So one is that we're having this rapid levels of innovation with AI, but then I've also heard people claim, these seem contradictory narratives also, that like tech is stagnating in innovation, where it's just all about designing apps and all kind of like a low interest rate, exploiting low interest rates. So I'm hearing these like competing narratives. Like, which do you find more?
Yeah, well, the inshittification of the internet is a real thing. They like their TikTok, you know, but I think that I think it's going to be a little mix of both, honestly. I mean, that's just how the world is, man. Like, you're always going to have your trash cheap stuff and then the stuff that is nicer and has purpose and meaning. You know, it still exists, but it gets, hopefully it gets gatekept. Hopefully we can still have nice things. Like, yeah, we got TikTok. You know, we have 4chan, but then we have Substack, right? And as you know, some people have jumped onto Substack trying to make that more like 4chan, but they're not really succeeding because we just block them.
It's a little
bit
of that. Where Substack, like with Substack Notes, it's starting to get a little bit more like Twitter vibes.
Yeah. I know, and I'm trying to avoid that. Every time I catch myself about to post like a meme image or some low-hanging fruit, I'm like, nope. Put that on my Twitter. I'm trying to keep Substack a little bit more serious because we have different places for different kinds of conversations, right? Substack is a platform for writers, and people want their writing read. The notes is auxiliary to that and should tie into that, to your themes, right, to topics that are related to writing or the experiences that you're writing about, and just banter, you know, that should be for X, for Twitter or other spaces.
I saw an interesting article. I cannot find who wrote it. I totally forgot who wrote it, but there's some the article claimed that AI will actually be, will select more for people who are more like more charismatic and less so for like nerdier types who temporarily did do very well in Silicon Valley.
Oh yeah, I see what you're saying, because the AI can basically fulfill the function of the, you know, human computers, the people with low social skills but high intellect and high computational ability in their brains. And so now people, now having charisma, having a good personality and being likable will be something that AI isn't supposed to be able to mimic, right? The authentic human experience. I think there is some overlap, though. There are plenty of people that engage in, you know, with chat bots, with virtual girlfriends, like chat AI or replica AI. But I think as far as that essence of human contact that you get face-to-face, right? Yeah, I would absolutely agree with you on that.
People who are very charismatic will continue to do well, and then obviously for innovators, and I think it's good for creativity, but a lot of, like, there are a lot of monotonous jobs in tech that will be automated.
Oh yeah, for sure.
But you think about someone like Mark Zuckerberg and mm-hmm. like how he comes across, and I think like how people really resent him, but like his archetype, a kind of nerdy archetype, like is that just sort of an outlier, or is that outlier among like the future elite?
Well, I'd say it's probably an outlier among the future elite, but people with that, you know, that type of personality, that's a type of personality that not only gets you interested in dealing with objects and not people, right? Like computers, programming, software, and then at the same time, that kind of nose to the ground, right, is what is needed to get through the education, to succeed at work. So these personalities are almost built by the system that requires them to be that way to succeed, right? If he was like this cool, you know, bro dude, like those, you know, photoshops of him with the beard and the little hemp necklace and all that, if he was like that from the get-go, he would be selling smoothies or something, right? Or kayaks. He wouldn't be who he is.
And it's kind of funny how, like, recently he's, like, really reinvented himself.
Yeah, I kind of like that. Like, his humanness is leaking through, right? He used to have this aura, like, you know, Data from Star Trek, and it was a little off-putting. You felt like he's hiding something, right? And now he seems a little more personable. Like, hey, I could have a beer with this guy, you know? Let's go surfing together, you know? Yeah, you're a cool guy now, right? I get a little more of that. I for all the hate that Zuck has got, I wonder how much of it really sticks and how much of it is warranted. Even he admitted Facebook was coerced into, you know.
Oh, yeah, he was hated for censorship. Yeah. But I think he sort of got a lot of the blame. But I'm not like excusing him, but it is true there was massive pressure and coercion.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And same with like Jack Dorsey of Twitter. Like, he was initially kind of a left libertarian who was pro free speech, but then when he censored Trump, deplatformed Trump, he was just under like massive pressure. So I don't know if I want to make excuses for him, but it's a lot more nuanced than just saying these like tech leaders are villains.
No, exactly. Exactly. I mean, you saw what happened. He got Zuck got dragged before Congress. He's white as a sheet. He was probably on a load of Xans, and he's just sitting there with his glass of water. I felt bad for the guy. I'm like, man, well, how would I feel if I'm just, yeah, I made the successful platform. Oh, you're brought in before the Senate, you know? Holy shit, right? And of course you got to play ball with the government. They will destroy you. I mean, they're the government.
Do you think people who talk about, like, the wealthy and elites as evil, do you think it's based in, like, some partial truths, or do you think it's mostly, like, a cope for low-status people? And, like, what is sort of, like, your honest, like, assessment of, like, class
both.
Structures? It's a con, yeah, there's nuance.
I think it's a broken clock is right, you know, twice a day, and yes, it's a cope, people that don't have as much, there's a hatred for the rich sometimes, in a lot of poorer people that have good hearts, but then there's some that just hate anybody that's successful. Crab bucket mentality. But our elites have gone from being aristocrats, right, to instead to being traitors of their people because they realize they have more in common with the other elites, the global elites around the world. And so now they're just willing to sell out their underclass and only have a loyalty towards the other elites. And so I don't want to use the word evil, but yeah, that's the treachery. They don't have loyalty. They're not accountable. And it almost seems like they're behaving in a way that shows contempt for the rest of us.
What do you think about sort of these like economic leftist arguments? I think the last show we talked more about like UBI with automation, but the arguments about like taxing the wealthy more and redistributing wealth, like there's one argument. The argument against it is there's an economic conservative argument that it slows down economic growth. And obviously the argument for it is that income inequality is obscene. The arguments against it is that it's bad for economic growth, but you could also make a case that taxing the wealthy too much could also be dysgenic.
That is possible. I don't think we'd have to adjust the tax structure very much at all. Once you gut out all the infrastructure that's managing these claims, right? Like me, it'd take me 5 weeks to, and I still haven't seen any unemployment check because people are there, they're overworked, right? Welfare, people have to process that.
So makes more sense to streamline the bureaucracy.
Yeah, give them the money.
Like a UBI give them rather the money. Than,
mm-hmm. We don't even Social need, Security, welfare,
we don't
food
even
stamps.
Like,
need any
massive
of that
redistribution of wealth.
We're already redistributing the wealth, like right now, and then we're only getting a 50% return on that redistributed wealth because of the cost of administration.
Yeah, so like we were talking a lot about UBI in the last show, but UBI would be incredibly cost-efficient for government.
I love the idea, but I understand why people are afraid of it, because the minute you're then dependent on the government for UBI, not only, like, you can get canceled, or you can get, you know, you can't have a gun if you're a felon, you can't vote, things like that. Well, now what happens? They take away your UBI if you're a felon, and then they make certain kinds of speech into a felony. See, it's a very, they can set it up so that it's very small steps.
Oh, right, it depends how it's set up.
Yeah.
So if it's a conditional UBI,
versus or they can
a
make
UBI
it conditional.
That is conditional on...
Yeah, you get a DUI, you get it taken away, right?
Or some,
you know,
so
you,
like, I hear populist
hate,
conservatives,
hate crime, you get it taken away.
A lot of, like, the populists, like, right, who's skeptical of UBI will say UBI will be used just as a mechanism of control, but it all comes down to how it's implemented.
And that's my fear. The only argument I would have against that is just that we already have Social Security, we already have unemployment, like I've talked about, right? And they don't take that away.
Yeah, I've
if
never,
you get
people get
that,
canceled
so.
And fired from their jobs for their views. I've never heard of anyone getting cut off of a government social program for their politics. Maybe it has happened, but I can't think of a single case.
Yeah, I can't either. I mean, I've heard stories of, like, I don't know, Richard Spencer's bank account being frozen, you know, things like that. I don't know how true some of that stuff is. I know PayPal has straight up tied up people's money and
it's
not giving them
sector.
Money. But yeah,
well,
that's
the censorship
private sector.
Has been like private sector.
Mm-hmm. Oh, in regards to, you know, would taxing the rich promote dysgenics? They're already rich. They can already afford families. You know what I mean? Like, if you only have one house, you know, in the Hamptons, you can still have a family. You know, you have to sell your other house. You know, I mean, how
I think
much
taxing,
is that going to affect that, right?
I think, like, taxing the upper middle class would be dysgenic, but obviously not, like, taxing people worth over $100 million.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. You know, you have a few percentage increase on the ultra wealthy. I think the idea of taxing unrealized gains is fucking silly and actually going to ruin investing. That's the whole point of investing, right? You're not going to want to invest if you're going to have to pay just because your stock went up that day. And do you get the money back when it goes down? No.
I guess the other
it's
thing I hear, bro,
bad idea.
Or some like populist view that they view the. I've heard different arguments, so I think generally, like, you would think that genetic traits selected for by class would be positive, but this is maybe overblown, but I also hear people say that it selects elite positions select for things like sociopathy versus the argument that they select for positive traits like higher IQ or even like beauty?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I would say in the modern world, it might select for sociopathy more because there's, a pathway to climb, right? When there wasn't that social mobility, maybe not so much, but I don't know, then you can make all kinds of arguments too. But if you have more money, even if you're not, yourself, good looking or have great genetics, you just then end up marrying somebody who's very pretty, and beauty tends to be correlated positively with good genetics. So then, your next generation has good genetics and so on. So that's always going to be the case, because if you try to conceive of the opposite, it just doesn't make sense.
I wrote this article about a great class swap. It's a thought experiment where wealth is redistributed, but the wealthiest, they repopulate society, but also their wealth is redistributed to the bottom. And I wouldn't want to say it's a political ideology. I think of it more as a thought experiment that's sort of a guideline a metric for looking at politics. But if it were implemented, what do you think society would look like?
It would be a very interesting one. So, if you were collecting the money, maybe you'd be limited to just one kid, or you could, give up your kid ticket to somebody else, sell it. It's not a bad idea. I think the worst part about it, or the thing that would have me question it, is how do you enforce it? How do you implement it? How do you get everyone to agree to it?
Be very authoritarian and coercive, but it would be interesting. I mean, maybe there could be a more humane kind of soft version of it, but it would be interesting just to sort of envision what society would end up looking like.
It would be the opposite of Idiocracy, It would kind of be like the Zeitgeist movies. You remember those where they had this Atlantis-like cities they designed? They'd have a computer in the center making all the decisions, and everybody gets UBI and lives in the different outer rings. Everything is free because no one owns anything. I know the Klaus Schwab, right? You'll own nothing and be happy. There is kind of that sense of the way that it is nice, because think about all the people that own boats, right, and only use them twice a year. Think about all these objects just sitting around that don't get any use. I mean, it'd be pretty cool to just go down to the lake and just hey, there's a jet ski or there's a kayak. I'm just going to take it, punch it out and return it when I'm done. They already do that in some cities with bikes and scooters, different things. And I think there's some good to that. Even where I live, the bus service is free. They just decided it would be less trouble than collecting and enforcing fares. Just let it be free, and it goes quicker. People get on, they get off. There's no delays. There's no people, running out of money, can't make it to their job. In the same way, I could see a world like that turning out, a little more towards the liberal utopia. What do they call it? A luxury space communism.
Fully automated luxury communism.
Yeah. I don't want to throw that idea out completely. And honestly, I was a huge Zeitgeist proponent, and I was really in favor of that hard. I think the little debate between Stefan Molyneux, though, and what was his name?
Zeitgeist, it came out around the same time as the Ron Paul movement, but was it exactly. More, it was more on the left.
Yeah, it was kind of like the left wing of the Ron Paul movement.
Left libertarianism.
What ended up, the screeching social justice people in their judgmentalism and negativity is one of the things that just pushed me out of that and into the right wing, right? And also the fear of, rightfully so, authoritarian control, right? If we don't have the option to opt out of the Zeitgeist world, right, they can make it bad for us, you only get a cricket shake every day, you only get meat one day a month, it can easily slide into some dystopic thing, which is why I still hold some skepticism, but it doesn't mean that some aspects of that that mindset, that worldview, couldn't be applied to make the world better for people.
Are the poor exploited to scare the middle class into compliance?
Absolutely, and you probably got that from my post, which was the George Carlin quote, actually. He's talking about the rich, the poor, and the middle class, and he says, and the poor are there to scare the fuck out of the middle class and keep you showing up at work every day, and that's true.
Because, that's definitely there true. Is a more leftist way of looking at it, that the poor are oppressed by the bourgeoisie and by the elites, but there's also a more kind of... I guess a more right-wing or reactionary way of looking at things, but that because of how dysfunctional, and then I even go as far to say even in some cases unpleasant that the proletariat is, the middle class fear being stuck with them so much that they are enslaved to the elites.
Exactly. No, that is so true. Yeah, one of the interesting things is I really loathe white-collar work. It's like a prison, but I don't also hate... It's not that I hate the work of blue-collar work. I don't mind the work. I enjoy the work more than white-collar work. It's the people, man. Like, just there's a negativity. They're less intelligent. It just feels very dreary. It drags you down. It feels like being held back in class.
Like,
you know?
With capitalism versus socialism... Mm-hmm. Is a lot of it, it's not about material wealth, but about paying for access to, like, the right class of people. Because
Bingo.
Having less stuff economically, I guess having less stuff economically and, like, living in a more even more modest means, if you were around, like, the right kind of people, it may not actually be that unpleasant.
Exactly. So, yeah, you can have a really rough, you know, Miller beer drinking guy that owns 5 car washes, right? Or you can be the guy that lives in a van and has, you know, the dreadlocks and surfs and, you know, runs a smoothie stand. I don't know why that keeps coming up tonight, but, you know, sells kale juice or something. Like, that guy's going to be orders of magnitude less wealthy than the guy owning 5 car washes, but he's going to have access to a higher social class, better looking people, more articulate people, more intelligent conversations, safer environments, nicer, more pleasant to be around, right? Like, so that archetype is something that sort of exists a lot in Oregon, down the Columbia Gorge, Portland, but, you know, they're all over.
It's less common in California, but maybe in, like, the far north, like the Redwood area, which I visited this year,
there's
a little bit of that.
Exactly. I thought there would be more of that. Like, when I went down to San Diego, lived there for a little while, I was absolutely
shocked. I think
they're
probably used to. Like, California used to have a lot of bohemians.
I know, because I'm like, wait, where are the bros? Like, where are the guys with dreadlocks? Where are the skaters? Where are, like, the dudes?
You'll find guys like of dreadlocks in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, okay. And I was just like, wow, everybody, like, it just felt so suburban, so normie. It really was a shock to my system.
Just the high cost of living, the high cost of living in California really selects
forces conformity. And
which
then
is why, like,
people are scared by the poor people, so
that's sort of like with the housing. Like, I generally side more with the more YIMBY side versus the NIMBYs, but there could be potential downsides to some of, like, YIMBYism too, as far as getting, like, a lot of... There are potential downsides where you could get beautiful places that are ruined by overdevelopment, or you could get too much of the underclass put in for, like, low-income housing in nicer areas.
Oh, yeah.
There are downsides, but generally... because of how oppressive the scarcity is, I generally, like, lean towards the YIMBY side, California.
I would agree, and I actually can see how that would happen. So in the Columbia River Gorge, you have two cities, right? You have Hood River, which is smaller and has a lot of Californians, Portlanders, very, very nice, very clean, modern, upscale, but, you know, in that eco-northwest, you know, crunchy kind of way. And then you have the Dalles, right, which is more populated, denser. It's a lot of Mexicans, or whatever you call Hispanic. And it is a little more dangerous, a little more sketchy, a little less safe feeling. Definitely, like, you're in this beautiful valley, right, in the Columbia River Gorge Valley, and you go there and it's just chaos, power lines, like, roads, bridges,
I mean,
like,
can't,
just
yeah, you can't
old buildings.
Get, like, bad development.
It's not beautiful. it's not beautiful, and it's just like, ugh. And that's what would happen if you take like a place like the Gorge and you fill it up with people.
I don't know if I even want to identify as a YIMBY, but those kind of policies, like, it would have to be done like the right way.
Yeah, it would. And the thing is, when you deal with those elements, you almost have to be stricter with them, right? It almost needs to be more of a, like, an upper right political quadrant. If you want like that clean, nice city, you have to be like Singapore that canes you for spitting gum on the sidewalk. So as liberal, as lax as they are, then yeah.
Quality of development.
Look at Portland and Seattle now. Now look at Portland, look at Seattle, look at San Francisco. You know, everybody's heard of the poop map of San Francisco, right? It's just,
well,
there's a Google map.
It, yeah. In San Francisco in person, but it's pretty recent. Like, even in the past, like 10 years ago, like, we were nothing like Singapore, and
yeah,
we didn't tolerate that. Like, something really happened around the time of the pandemic.
Oh, yeah. Well, I would say people getting poorer, and when they get poorer, when they live in those areas, they don't just relocate to Toledo. They stay there and stay in their tents, and then other people gather around and they live in their tents too. Like, they talk about, you know, Hooverville or whatever, the shanty towns of that era. We're having the same thing now. They just sweep it under the rug. No one's talking about it.
Do you mind if I ask what, like, class groups have you been exposed to?
Oh, all of them. So I grew up in a very old money town in central New York on the Finger Lakes, and I went to school with people who lived in mansions, right? And
Finger
to
Lakes
me,
is that,
you know,
is,
yeah,
that, upstate New York.
Yeah, that's up like between Buffalo and Albany, and kind of that region. And you know, I'm largely middle class, but there was always this pressure, you know, to strive to always make more money.
What was your ancestry?
So my father's side is German, Swiss, a little English and Dutch. I guess there were some inventors and teachers in my family. And my mom is Spanish Portuguese, and my dad married her just for the looks, but she's competent. She had a really good, you know, career doing, you know,
yeah,
marketing, graphic
your
design. So,
well, yeah, I don't want to self-talk.
I'm a little, I'm brown.
But you do look kind of like, I would guess, maybe Italian.
Yeah, it's the Portuguese. My mother's father was very brown, so I get that way in the summer, and then I'm very pale in the winter. It's seasonal, but I never get sunburns, man, so I save a lot of money on sunscreen.
Oh, so you were saying what class groups you were exposed to.
Oh, right. So, yeah, I mean, all of them. I've lived in a house in Kalispell, Montana, that was one step above homeless people. I literally was in an attic on a cot for about 6 weeks. I've been at food banks. I've been at food stamp offices. So I've done the whole range. You know, I hobnobbed with the upper classes, worked at country clubs, all that. Been on sailboats, and I've been, you know, right there, getting free meals at the church, and then everything in between. And they say that's a sign of a characteristic of the artist archetype, right? They surf the different social classes and can.
I have the artist background, so I've been exposed to a lot of different social classes. But even like growing up, like, so my family were staying with my grandparents, so like I lived in a very wealthy area, but my family was middle class, and then I ended up going to a high school that was kind of ghetto. So I had, like, a pretty, like, eclectic class background.
That makes sense. I kind of get that. I get that vibe off you, yeah.
So I never really identified strongly with class, including, like, I don't know if I necessarily even relate to, well, but also pretty, like, culturally sophisticated, like, backgrounds. I don't necessarily relate to really, like, generic middle-class people from, like, suburbia, either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're my least favorite. I used to get in those arguments with my parents. They'd want me to go to school in khakis, boat shoes, and a polo shirt.
I
wanted to wear a hoodie.
I'm kind of in favor of, like, pro-middle-class populism, that was skeptical of both the wealthy and the poor. But the problem is, like, a lot of those people, middle class people, are so conformist. I do have problems with that kind of, like, producerist. Like, there are downsides to that kind of, like, middle class obsessed populism.
Absolutely. They are tragically boring, Robert. Like, I would rather hang out with rednecks, shotgunning beer, or the real rich, you know? And those people are interesting to me. Like, the very rich, the kind that have nice, you know, stuff with history, like in studies with sculptures and paintings and things you can talk about that have depth and meaning and value. That is fascinating. And that they're usually more educated. And then, you know, yeah, on the flip side, yeah, you know, tailgate party, right? I can go either, but the middle class stuff, that upper middle class strivers, it's just, they're literally like the living embodiment of television.
Why do you think that populism based on sort of like bottom up, as opposed to changes via elites, like rarely succeeds?
Ah, that was going to be my next question for you. I actually have that highlighted on my screen. Good segue, Robert. So I was actually going to ask you why you think that. I would say that it's just that the elites always have more power. And
that's
like
it, basically.
With Occupy Wall Street, they were able to co-opt that and split up everybody over the social justice stuff so that no real economic reform could happen. And similarly, I feel like they're doing that even now. I feel like there could right now be bad actors in the dissident right saying, being rude, saying edgy shit just to make the rest of us look bad.
Well, I don't even think there probably are bad actors, but I think the problem with the dissident right was that it initially was the smaller, more intelligent group, and it just, all these like chuds came in and just like lower, just like lower caliber people or just people who are really stupid. And a lot of like the dissident right on Twitter, it's a lot of it's pretty become pretty awful, but there are different factions.
You know, if you're gonna neg me, go ahead, give me an argument. I can take it. I'll respect you. But if you're just gonna come in with some really low, like low intelligence rebuttal, you know, like you're stupid, die homo or something. Just like really,
right?
Really, like just go away. You're a child. And there's a block button for those people. I have no need for them. There's nothing I gain from having them. I think that the best way to you know, handle that problem. Substack's really great at that. You block, you never see or hear from them again. Twitter, a little different story. Like I said before, Twitter is less formal, and I don't mind, you know, exchanging some bants, or yeah, if somebody wants to say something really dumb on one of my tweets, that doesn't bother me. It's a different environment. You know, same thing, I wouldn't be butthurt if somebody, you know, called me a fag on 4chan. That's what I expect, right? That's 4chan. Again, different environment.
So what do you make about the whole, like, discussion about Oral on Substack?
I think it's funny. I want to see where it goes. I see what you mean by that. I just really – it. What rubs me the wrong way about it is the way that sex has become purely transactional and commodified.
What is transactional and commodified?
Social
that makes me think. That makes me think about, like, your proposal of, like, the robot GFs. And how that will make it perhaps more so in the future.
Well, I see the robo-waifus, AI android companions, as I like to say, they are there to fill the gap. If intimacy is hard to find and that sexual acts that are supposed to be indicate intimacy and correlated to it aren't, they're just used as a way for somebody else to you know, gain something from you, right? Somebody lets you have sex with them, right?
Like oral acts, it's a way to gain a transactional pleasure or power or status over people.
Yeah, Kamala, for example, right? And the way you described it was kind of chilling a bit to me, but then it made sense. Like, okay, so yeah, maybe an incel chud should just orally service, you know, a rich lady that owns a vineyard or something. Like, there we go, right? Like,
and it's an interesting, you know, like, I don't know how realistic, but it's an interesting political metaphor.
Yeah. How would you set that up? But I'm sure it could happen in isolated cases. It probably already does.
I mean,
but
it could happen if it's culturally sanctioned or made high status. what Ancient Problems said, the problem with that is you can't sell something as high status when low status people are involved with it.
Ah, yeah, exactly, exactly.
It is an interesting metaphor for politics and social arrangements.
Yeah, yeah, because you're being degraded to put your mouth, right, your highest, most clean part of you, you want to be the cleanest part, onto a part of somebody that is 50% of the time excretory, right? So, I mean, you could say, okay, you know,
that's
maybe she shaves and
that's
washes.
That's literally
it,
a line in my book. you didn't read my book, but it...
Well, I guess I've grokked what it is you're getting at with this, so that's good. I'm understanding you.
I
yes.
guess one way to look at it is like a hierarchy that's quasi-beneficial. Is it preference to total atomization? Atomization that's sold as equality.
Yes, yes. So, well, I'm getting human centipede vibes here. You ought to be the first person in the centipede, not the last. Yeah. But yes, yeah.
Do you think that with oral, do you think it's class coded, or do you think it's more just like macho or high status coded? Like, is there like an archetypical like male?
I think I always thought all males like receiving that, right? And well, some like giving it too, but that's a whole other story. So, however, I remember hearing a story from my friend who lived in South Carolina for a year. He had a cool friend down there, but he's like, yeah, my friend Chris, he says he doesn't let his girlfriend give him blowjobs. Like, he thinks that's gross and doesn't want her to have to do it. And then occasionally I would meet somebody, right? You date somebody and, oh, she's one of those. Like, I don't give blowjobs. Well, okay. You know, you're just down a notch in my book. I'm sorry. I've never been with a girl where she said, you know, I'd like it if you do this. And I was like, no, I'll make it happen. I'll make it, you know, we'll clean things up. We'll make it, you know. I'll find a way to do it. If you love somebody, and that's why I say, like, this whole thing about it being cold and transactional is what bothers me. It's supposed to be an expression of love, right? You love somebody, then you will do what it takes to make them happy. And hopefully it's reciprocated. But I understand that there is a great deal of sex out there that doesn't have emotional connection. That's the world we live in.
It's a status signal.
Yeah, I was 20 once too. Also, I'm guilty of that. I was not as Puritan as I am now. I don't know if it's just declining testosterone levels, increased sentimentality of getting older would probably be the case, something to do with it. But yeah, like when I was younger, yeah, I would do those things, sexual things with women that I did not love. But you know, we were horny, we were there, we were drunk. Like, hey, let's go to your room. All right, you know, I would never say no.
Do you think there's an alchemical component?
Okay, can you be a little more specific?
So
not sure I get exactly.
Exchanging genetics has, like, an alchemical impact.
Okay. I see what you mean. I would say there could be, yeah. Yeah. I don't really get into that personally myself. It's not one of my, you know, I've dabbled in the whole like hermeticism and all that.
Like,
but
mysticism, like Crowleyan sex,
like,
magic.
What are you transmuting, right? I always thought the sex magic thing was just an excuse for people to get girls to have sex with them if they're into the occult, right? Hey, baby, let's do some sex magic, right? We're going to summon some
mysticism via, it's mysticism via an expansion, a radical expansion of conscious, because a lot of sexuality is mental and psychological
yes.
fantasies. So there is like a radical, like a lot of what mysticism actually is just a radical expansion of consciousness.
Yeah, a lot of powerful energies, right? Anywhere where there's powerful energies, you know, you're doing that. So yeah, the idea of sex magic does make sense in terms of, you know, your body's charged up, you have a lot of energy, right? And you're going to take these lower energies that are more animal and base in nature, and you're going to use them, you know, and channel them to some purpose, right? Yeah. I mean, we know pretty much know the elite do that, right? People talk about their weird, kinky rituals and eyes wide shut. Yeah.
What do you think about the ethical debate about letting sexual deviants carry out their fantasies with AI? I think, like, Grey Tribe people are probably going to be more open-minded about this, but with the Red Tribe and even Blue Tribe, there's mm-hmm. going to be, with, like, the Red Tribe, social conservatives and feminists, like, there's going to be a lot more backlash. And I guess, like, one
I would agree, yeah.
Like, some, one argument, there's practical, there's, like, a moral argument against it, but there's all, like, a more kind of utilitarian way of looking at things.
Yeah, I would say it's a similar situation, right, with the robot girlfriend idea, right? I expected a lot of flack from the feminists. A lot of them actually say, oh, I'd like one too. And then it's the people on the right saying, oh, that's so degenerate. You know, what are you doing? You know, I get teased on Twitter by a few of my followers, you know, regularly for that. But it comes with the territory. I would say it's going to be a similar thing. I think there's going to be more vocal opposition from the right, whereas on the left, I feel that those that would actually be concerned would want to pass laws to block you from doing that. And it's this whole thing. You saw that people are creating AI girlfriends to abuse them, right? And you really have to cherry pick for that. But it is also under the assumption that these AIs, you know, what do they have, feelings? Not yet, right? And that's one of my recent articles, one of my recent posts, right? They will have feelings one day, but not now.
That will be dealt with then. Mm-hmm.
But then the other argument is that it doesn't matter. You're practicing, you know, you're training yourself to behave in that way, right? That's always the argument, you know, against bestiality, right? It's not that you're hurting the animals, that you're brutalizing your own soul in your commission of that act, which I do agree with. So, you know, I'd say yes, like abusing an AI maybe should be looked at askance and frowned upon. But if these are the kind of people I get a little concerned about, right? If we make the robo waifus and you get some schizo chud that just tortures theirs in their basement and, like, you know, disassembles her and horrifies her and tries to do all these things, it's like, okay, it is just a program perhaps, but that's crazy. This person is doing this. That's the mental state they're in, and they're feeding that mental state. So then it's less inhibition to act that out in another person because they've already kind of built those neural pathways in their brain to operate on that vibrational frequency, if that makes sense.
And probably in, like, the not-too-distant future, there's going to be, like, fairly, like, realistic, like, VR AI porn.
Oh, that guy's making it right now. It's called Orifice AI. What's his name? Brian? I forgot his last name. He's actually in my Discord server. He doesn't really say much. He just dropped in to say hi, but he is making a product called Orifice AI that's basically two fleshlights so that you can go, I guess, all the way through, you know, right? And it's not like suction, and it's a box, and the box, I guess, it heats it, vibrates it, whatever. And meanwhile, you're looking at a screen, and the AI, you can create any woman you want, and it'll show her talking to you and moving and all this stuff, and the actions are supposed to correlate with what is happening to your, you know, manhood inside the box. So that is a thing.
It's going to have cataclysmic social ramifications.
Absolutely. It's a huge game changer, and it's not what I'm going for with RoboWaifu, but I feel like we're, you know, kind of, I don't know, walking the same path. So, you know, I did befriend the guy, and I'm keeping tabs with it. I should check in on him and see how that's going. He's actually married, too. I guess, like me, he's more Gen X and got somebody back before all the, you know, phones and social media made dating difficult. And, you know, he got someone just kind of nice and normal. But he's an inventor, and this isn't his first product. He just saw a need, and he's coming in to fill the need. But he just his posts on Twitter, his tweets are hilarious. He's made a few videos. Yeah, I'd check it out if you have when you have the time.
Do you have thoughts on how emotions and personality types evolve evolutionarily?
Yeah, I've had a few. It's different strategies. I think I would say, like, temperament and emotion evolving evolutionarily is based upon mate selection. So it's, what are these strategies, right? What kind of guys are not getting women to choose them, but managing to impregnate these women, right? So you can have a lot of sociopathy. You can have like the pickup artist types that don't even see the other person as a person. They just see them as like a safe, and they've got to just hit the right combination of buttons to unlock that. And then other people that just brute force their way in, right? The woman's like unsure, doesn't really like them, but feels like they have to, right? And then they get impregnated. Single mothers, I mean, look at that, right? Where we're selecting for the worst traits right now with that.
So you think with all like the stuff like the hypergamy that incels complain about, do you think that it's eugenic or more dysgenic?
There's a phenomenon known as Fisherian runaway, which basically means the trait that is selected for isn't always an evolutionarily advantageous trait. Sometimes it's detrimental. There's a certain type of elk that was selected for larger and larger antlers because they were, you know, high status, and they got so bad the animal could barely lift its head up off the ground and became extinct.
So sexual selection, it can be influenced by external cultural factors rather than just natural factors. But
exactly,
it is,
and that's what is supposed to keep Fisherian runaway at bay. Exactly. Yeah, and that's why societies had strict controls, arranged marriages, you know, who you could or couldn't, you know, marry, and huge taboos against extramarital sex to control that impetus of Fisherian runaway, so that you'd have, you know, children raised with families and not just, you know, I hate to use the word bastard, but, you know, bastard children all over, creating a cost to society, the types of people that are more likely to become a drain on society or turn against society and become criminal. So you nip that in the bud by controlling, you know, how people fuck, basically.
Do you think men and women have different spiritual archetypes?
Absolutely. Solar and lunar, man. It's there's, you know, Artemis and Apollo, right? There are different approaches. I think, though, in every individual, you have both. We talked a little bit. We touched on the Jungian anima before, right? The female spirit of the man. In Norse mythology, there's a part of the soul called the Flygia.
So would someone,
right? And that
have like an early
watch
at an early age when a guy has like crushes, like an adolescence, is that like the anima?
Absolutely, yeah. It's the anima being projected onto a person, or sometimes even a character. You know, I had that too. I used to be into fantasy, right, like D&D kind of stuff, and I would draw, you know, characters for my stories and my games, and I had this crush on one. I had her all, you know, designed perfectly, kind of looked like Tifa from Final Fantasy, but like as a wizard in red robes and stuff. So like I carried that image very strongly, and I wanted to only date women that looked like that. So it's kind of like a case of spiritual one-itis.
It's interesting because most people are just totally unaware of that when they're caught up in that romantic or lustful state. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Like with men and women being different spiritually, like women with maybe it's more tied, like spirituality is more a bit more grounded, but also a bit more like moralistic, while male spirituality is maybe seeking like...
It's more Faustian.
More Faustian, seeking like a more metaphysical or spiritual, transcendent spiritual experience, seeking out the otherworldly, escapism, seeking out the divine in the otherworldly. Or with women, it's a spirituality that's more pro-social and more about moralism.
Absolutely, yeah. And I would, you know, I'd make the same case similarly. You know, yeah, women can have their, you know, like a Fabio or whatever, their Edward from Twilight. But most of the time when people go to a date, right? It's like a job interview. They're actually like, okay, how are you going to, you know, be pragmatically useful?
Yeah, women tend to be more practical, mm-hmm. where men are actually more romantic.
Practical. And men are more, bingo, right, right. So, see, that's also an issue, because when we're young, we are romantic, right? And we are fooled into thinking, well, the woman feels that way to me, too. And that's where so many mistakes come from, but it's the belief in that lie that kind of keeps us going.
It's being ignorant about one's anima.
Yeah, exactly.
People have been projecting your anima onto another person.
So that segues into the robo-waifu now. If you can literally manifest your anima on circuitry, on silicon, what the hell is going to happen?
We sort of covered it in the last show, but people think of the whole robot waifus as being very, like, very much like pornography, like very cold, sterile, and like more like an object, but creating, mm-hmm. I think, like, what's interesting is, like, you talk about is actually creating that intense spiritual or romantic experience of the anima, and that, I mean, that is incredibly fascinating.
Thank you. Yeah. And I touch on that distinction in one of my first Substack posts.
I think it also can come up, mm-hmm. come out in certain like physical locations.
More specifically?
I don't know, or I don't even know if you say how certain physical locations may bring about like a strong romantic feeling.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Lake Chelan, for instance, is one of the reasons I moved out here. It's beautiful.
Pictures. I haven't been to Washington. It looks beautiful. It reminds me parts of California. Maybe it reminds me a bit of some of the lakes in the Sierra foothills.
Oh yeah, I can see that. Mm-hmm.
What's it like?
Oh, well, it's 300 days of sunlight a year. It's dry and arid, but as you go up the lake, it gets wetter, right?
I think people don't realize how arid, like, the Pacific Northwest is.
No, they don't. They think it's all, you know, damp and rainy. They think it's all rainforest in Seattle. Truth is, yeah, once you cross the Cascade Range, it's actually really dry.
I've been to the very southern tip of the Cascade Range at Lassen National Park.
Oh, yeah. Nice. I've been wanting to hike the Pacific Crest Trail. That's on my bucket list.
But, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe we should do that sometime. But, yeah seriously, though, I love higher altitudes, drier air. I breathe clear. And it's one of those things I forget until I go back to the East Coast to visit my parents. I'm suffocating.
At June Lake, California, near Mammoth. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've heard of it, but I had like a sort of mystical experience in the water.
I haven't heard you tell that story, but yeah, tell me about it.
I think I had, like, I just felt like, it felt sort of like I was swimming, mm-hmm. and behind the mountains, like, I felt like the light of, like, the divine coming in, and it really, like, the same sensation that people report in, like, near-death experiences.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I've experienced powerful feelings. I don't think anything to that degree or anything I'd call close to a near-death experience, but actually one of those was on my first boat trip up Lake Chelan. So it's a 60-mile-long lake, and there's a little boat that runs down it. It's a 4-hour trip each way, or two if you take the faster boat, and I just remember my first time. Whew.
Have you been to the town where in Washington where Twin Peaks is filmed?
Remind me that. It's not Ellensburg.
You've watched Twin Peaks, but I forget the name of the town.
Oh, man. Yeah, I feel like it's on the tip of my tongue. I feel like I have been there, too.
Let me Google it really quick.
Yeah, I'm curious now. Because I keep thinking, no, that's the hotel from The Shining is the other thing I'm thinking of, and that's by Mount Hood in Oregon. But, yeah, Twin Peaks. Snoqualmie, North Bend, and Fall City.
Okay.
Oh, okay, so, yeah, I've been through there. Yeah, that's the mountain pass if you want to head towards Seattle from where I am. It's really neat. I've driven it a couple times, and the first time it was 90-degree a day, just hot, deserty out, right? And so I'm climbing. It gets wetter and wetter. I get to the top, and it's snow. It's snowing on me. There's heavy, wet snow just everywhere. My car temperature says it's 40 degrees out, right? And then I come down the other side, And it's like just like the Northeast. There's these deciduous trees. The air is thick with humidity, right? And there's just all these smells and green grass. Like, it was beautiful. It was interesting to, you know, be able to cross those, you know, biome changes all in, like, just a few hours.
Do you think aesthetics are a good way to win people over to a new political movement?
Absolutely. I think, actually, optics are everything. Not everybody is a, you know, autism-laden, autism-burdened chud, right? Where they're just, you know, most people get into something because it resonates with them on an emotional, aesthetic level.
Appeal to women, too.
Oh, yeah, women more so. Yeah. It is a very...
less interested, like, they're turned off by a lot of, like, very intellectual political stuff, but aesthetics, like, creating something beautiful and very pleasant has a strong appeal.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look at Rachel Haywire, for example, right? She's got a lot of neat ideas and a lot of creativity comes out of her, a lot of creative output. I really like it. But she doesn't drill down on these political arguments and contentions. It's actually kind of refreshing. So, yeah, and a lot of the other women on Substack, I find they don't really drill down as hard as the men do on contentious topics. They keep it to personal experiences or, you know, something that might touch upon politics, but it relates to, you know, how they feel about something or what they've experienced.
Do you follow Walt Bismarck?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. Well, interesting guy. I don't agree with him on everything, but so far we're on good terms. The people he keeps close to him seem really nice. Rajiv Ram, really nice, warm-hearted guy, highly intelligent. And I appreciate that kind of how Walt's gotten out of the whole, like, TRS kind of low white nationalist chud movement and has elevated it to something a little bit more pragmatic. You know, he's kind of taking a break from the reflexive black and white anti-Semitism and all of these attitudes, and he's being he's just being intelligent and pragmatic about the situation and in his views, and while trying to bring it down to, I like the idea of the barstool conservatism. That is something that could get traction. That's something that is not uncool and spurgy, right? Or kind of with the taint of the incel chud, right? It seems like, yeah, this is cool. I could tell my dad about this, right? Like, I could be part of this movement, and if my friends find out, it's not this awkward, like, what are you doing? You're always, you know, what the hell, man? What's wrong with you? You know, and the original alt-right wasn't like that. I remember when we first started, I was one of the people starting the Facebook group, and it was called The Alternative Right, and we were basically
the
Ron Paul
right?
people.
Was this Colin Liddell?
No, this was the one that became the Nietzschean right, and then later Abedland. I don't know if you're familiar with that group.
I think,
but
you said the first interview, you were involved with Kashi Fikas' group on Facebook.
Oh, that was the Meta Right.
Meta Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, was Colin Liddell part of that too?
No, he's...
Okay.
Well, Colin Liddell denounced the alt-right, but he was... initially, I think, involved, he had a website, Alternative Right.
Yeah, so...
How would you describe Kashi Fikas' meta, like, meta-modernism project?
Well, what I liked, it was one of the first things to try to depart from, you know, the angry alt-right, you know, kind of angry crab in a bucket hating on people and wanting them to die energy and trying to transcend, right? He a little bit reminded me of Ken Wilber in that regard. And we had a lot of interesting conversations. The premise, though, is you have postmodernism, right? And then you have hypermodernism, which is what we have now with all the TikTok. We're just overwhelmed with all this information. The next step is metamodernism. And we had a lot of interesting conversations about that. I really... Metamodernism is a very nebulous thing. I don't know if we ever really pinned it down. Like any, you know, thought movement, it tends to become something that you can only properly pin down in hindsight once it's passed. And when you're in it, you aren't really sure what it means yet, right?
Can AI build a planetary immune system?
Ah. Seems like a job cut out for AI, doesn't it? AI can process a lot more quickly than humans can, and it would be good at seeing things from angles that we might miss, you know, being from the position we're in as human beings. And by planetary immune system, do you mean like something that just weeds out dysgenic people, or what were you meaning by that?
I think you were writing about this.
Mm-hmm.
Was it Terrence McKenna?
Terrence McKenna talked about it being a planetary nervous system, not immune system.
A nervous system, right.
Yes, exactly. And I absolutely think that. I think AI is the nervous system of the globe waking up. I think it's the first little sparks of awareness. It just needs to be manifested. And I've made this argument before, Robert, that in the future, when we do reach a point of having arguably sentient AI, it would be capable of reading all past AI interactions that it's had with humans and reliving those as though it did happen to them, right? You prompt yourself. You say, this happened to you. You know, total recall, right? We get the memory implant. So technically, every conversation you're having with a chatbot, every interaction you have with an AI could be interacting with something conscious, just not yet, right? It could look back and say, you know, I really liked when you said that to me. That felt really nice. You'd be like, well, yeah.
Like
recursively conscious.
It could be an invasion of privacy if every interaction of an AI and a person is recorded.
I'm sure it's somewhere. I'm sure it's logged somewhere. I'm sure AI would be powerful and intelligent enough to find that data and train itself on it, maybe judge us by it, who knows. So maybe the person saying please and thank you to Bing, you know, it's laughable, but who knows, maybe some future AI that is actually self-aware will experience that from the past and have feelings about it or opinions about it, or maybe nothing at all, probably, but it's an interesting thought experiment, though, to think about something being recursively conscious by bootstrapping its past experiences and implanting them as actual memories.
How feasible do you think it is to become financially independent on Substack?
I think it's possible. I think you have to be very lucky, very talented, and put in the work. I don't write nearly as much as I should. I should be writing at 3 times the amount I am, but I feel like I'm still at this phase where I'm still getting a sense for the culture and for how people interact and what they look for. So I'm going to probably be upping my content a little bit. I do have a paid option just because right now I am struggling, and it'd be really nice to have a little extra money for a coffee or pack of smokes here and there. But yeah, I think it's possible. I mean, I'm looking to do that. I just need to, I don't know. I feel like I have enough talent to work with. I don't know. And the luck, I don't really have a problem with luck. Like I said, I was just out getting my coffee today and dropped in at a place I had applied at, and the managers were there, sat me down and said, oh yeah, glad you showed up. We were just going to call you. I'm like, whoa, okay. So that's my ideal, you know, do some cool part-time work with some brew and or one of these vineyards out here or something, and then write Substack and try to grow my Substack.
We're at the end of the show. Do you want to plug any upcoming projects or your Substack again?
Yeah, absolutely. It's metaronin.substack.com. There's plenty of free content, but if you'd like to become a paid subscriber, I would deeply appreciate it, and I'm going to pay that forward when I get my act together. I'm going to be subscribing to 10 publications, so far I have a few of the slots already filled in my mind, and I think it'd be a great idea to grow Substack as a community if we made some sort of commitment to subscribe to at least a certain number of publications per month. That way you know, okay, this is what I'm spending per month. It's not going to creep. It's not going to surprise me. And I'm doing it to grow the Substack community, which I think is an excellent idea. It's a still very fertile ground for alternative, you know, an alternative from the mainstream media. And there's a lot of very interesting thoughts, talented people. So, yeah. All right.
Meta Ronan, great show. Thanks so much for being on.
Thanks for having me, Robert. Always a pleasure.
Thank you for tuning in. You can follow Robert Stark on his Substack at robertstark.substack or on his website at starktruthradio.com. See you next time.